This podcast is brought to you by The Province.
The Province Sports Podcast.
Welcome to Province Sports Radio, Fridays with Ed Willis. I'm Paul Chapman, joined by Ed. Ed, how are things for you today?
Well, I'm still trying to expunge the memory of the last Canucks debacle from my memory banks, but it's fresh in my mind and probably fresh in a lot of people's minds, too.
You asked the question, Ed. Is this a crisis, or again, is this what we expect?
Well, I'm thinking of the Tommy Lee Jones line from No Country for Old Men. If it isn't, it'll do until one comes along. it certainly looks that way. I mean, you can fiddle around with the overtime losses and, you know, maybe give them a little room there. But I think top to bottom, really, since that road trip, and so this has now been going on for the better part of a month, there is a level of play there which should be concerning to alarming. For Canucks fans.
How so for you? Is it effort? Is it like, is this team just overmatched? Is it a lack of confidence?
Honestly, I think it's that simple. I mean, you know, maybe they could manage Ryan Miller's minutes better. Maybe they can, you know, configure their lines a little better. Maybe, you know, when they get healthy, they'll be better. But top to bottom, they're just not good enough. They're like virtually every team in the NHL, it's the same story. You look at them at the start of the season, there's five or six things that have to go right for them. In the Canucks case this season, they had to really, really go right. From where I sit, just one of those things have gone right, and that's the Sedins. The other stuff they needed to happen, they needed Verbata to be a 30-goal scorer again. That hasn't happened. They needed Bo Horvat to take another step. That hasn't happened. They needed their kids to really make an impact on their lineup. Now, they haven't been a problem, but you can't really say they've made a huge impact on their lineup. They needed great special teams, and their special teams have been really bad since the first month of the season. So you add it all up, and that's what that was my takeaway from the 4-2 loss against Dallas on Thursday night. They're just not good enough to compete with the top teams. You know, when they're throwing guys over the board, like Valeri Nichushkin was awesome. He scored a highlight reel goal. He set up another one. He's probably Dallas's fifth or sixth best forward. You know, and then they throw out Ben, and they throw out Tyler Seguin, and they throw out Jason Spezza, and they throw out Patrick Sharp, who scored the game-winning goal. The Canucks have the Twins and then 10 other guys, and that's it.
So let me ask you this then. Should we be worried by the fact that Dan Hamhuis and Radim Verbata, et cetera, don't look up to snuff? Or is it more that, oh my God, are we going to hurt the development of Bo Horvat and Jake Virtanen and Jared McCann? Is that more the issue that stuck in a bad situation with pressure on them, falling into bad habits, is doing more harm than good?
Yeah, and that's a great question. And I think it depends. The answer depends on how you viewed this season. For me, this season was always more about development than results. And the best way, and I do support kind of the party line that the best way to develop these kids is in a semi-successful program, watching established veterans, having a little bit of taste of success. And so, you know, they're not inundated with pressure. There isn't this like overwhelming sense that they have to contribute and they have to be difference makers, and they can kind of, you know, slide great. You know, their careers can evolve. And I don't see that happening this year. And that really should be the worrisome part.
So the narrative kind of at the start of the season, after it was determined that they were staying, McCann, and I speak specifically of McCann and Virtanen, was that, you know, this was a good experience for them. They belonged here, everything else, which you can kind of say that. When things started to stall for them a little bit and the team didn't look so tragic, there was an issue around, okay, well, maybe it would be good for them to go to the World Juniors and experience success, et cetera, be leaders, all that kind of stuff. Seeing Jason Botchford's take on it this morning is, well, with Sutter out long-term, your second line is absolute garbage, and they're going to need McCann in that role. You subscribe to that, or do you think it's still a better experience long term to send those guys into the national program?
I think it's two separate cases. I think in Virtanen's case, he needs some positive news. He needs something to feel good about himself. McCann has been fine. There are too many nights, in fact, where he's their best forwards after the Sedins and Yannick Hansen, and that says so much about the Canucks. So for me, give Virtanen a shot at the World Junior, bring him back and see if that's a tonic for him. And for McCann, just keep plugging him in and hope he continues to do what he does and maybe even show a little bit of improvement here over the second half of the season.
And because of these storylines, are the Sedins having what may be their most impressive season ever considering the circumstances, and is that a danger of being overlooked?
Yeah, and again, it depends how you judge it, but for me, it's as impressive as anything they've done as Canucks. They're going out every night and they're facing the other team's top line, and they always have. But there was in the background, there was always a Ryan Kessler. There was something that the team could throw at them to, you know, distract the opposition a little bit. That isn't happening this year. If the Twins don't get it done, it just doesn't get done. So the fact that they're even as marginally competitive as they are is a tribute to Daniel and Henrik. And the goaltending has been, I think it's held up its end of the bargain. It hasn't been spectacular, but it's been, I'd say it's been above average.
You raised a point when you send over the topics that you'd like to talk about for this podcast where you look at the history of the Canucks and that's in all of a sudden making you feel like something's building and then it evaporates awfully quickly. They're certainly not the only franchise that's sort of experienced that, but to me, yeah, they've never had this long build. You mentioned the West Coast Express. You know, the Vigneault success of 2011 came about fairly quickly and they were an elite team for a while, and that did unravel very quickly within 2 years. What is it about this franchise that
I wish I could give you a great answer there, and I don't know what it is, but what made me start thinking about that is they're bringing in the West Coast Express to fet them, and I believe it's Monday's game, and you know, that was such a enjoyable moment for Canucks fans. It lasted 2 years. Todd Bertuzzi was like the best power forward in the NHL for 2 years. And that was it. And then he was gone. He signed that contract. And then Steve Moore came along and he was at the door. But people forget he was dreadful long before March 8th of 2003, I think it was. 2004. I'm sorry. It was just, you know, all of a sudden, you know, like that team erupted and there was really nothing to suggest this was going to happen. Like Bertuzzi was kind of this, you know, intriguing prospect who hadn't fulfilled potential. Naslund was, you know, the great Alex Stoyanov trade. Brian Burke had engineered this goofy trade for Pavel Bure where he got Ed Jovanovski and a bunch of other stuff. But all of a sudden, the parts all came together and coalesced. And it looked like they were going to be a force to be reckoned with for a number of years. They really had 2 years together, that 01-02 team that threw a bit of a scare into Detroit until Nicholas Lidstrom, and then the 03 team, which really probably had the best chance of any Canucks team outside of 2011 to do some damage in the playoffs. And lost to Minnesota!
Well, lost to Minnesota, up 3-1, lead in the third period, goal flips over the net, hits Dan Clucci. I know this isn't a historical podcast, but in hindsight, I actually think that might have been their best chance to win a cup, even more so than 2011.
It was set for them.
Yeah. They get Anaheim in the conference finals and then New Jersey in the final. And
I know. Now, I guess the flip side to that was they didn't have a goalie, so it's probably illogical to think they could have done it.
But you think the Devils would have scored on it? You could have played without a goalie with that Devils team. And I remember the first game one of the Minnesota-Anaheim Western Conference final. It was, to use the correct parlance, it was nil-nil into double overtime.
No, I know. You're right in that. And as I recall, Anaheim swept Minnesota, did they not, in 4 games?
In one of the worst series I have ever seen in my life.
You're right, in the final was dreadful. And it went 7 games to that final, and it was unwatchable. I think of these wild spikes, and, you know, and I understand things are cyclical in sports, and teams are going to have ups and downs. But with the Canucks, they're just so extreme. It's just so jarring. And what, you know, the other part, you know, to come full circle and tie it in, because it looks like they're headed for another crisis. I don't know if it's going to be Tortorella-esque in its scope, but it has a chance to be. And you're already starting to hear stories about ownership getting antsy, and they're taking a long, hard look at Willie Desjardins, and Trevor Lunden took this job, with guarantees that he'd be able to run the show as he saw fit. Desjardins was his handpicked man. Jim Benning was his handpicked man. Now, if the order comes from on high, I mean, I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves, but we've seen how this plays out in the past, and it's not great.
Taking the longer term view, I was actually a little surprised to read that the current longest winning streak of one team over another in the NHL is 10 games now of the Stars over the Canucks. They're 12-3 in their last 15 against them, but yeah, I've won 10 in a row. Of course, Tom Gilardi's very happy with that. So I wanted to ask you this in that long range view. Are the Canucks headed down the right path? And I ask that because when I look at Dallas, which was a team that had young promise for a long time, the one thing they have that you would say is different is, and I know it's so ridiculous to say this, is Sagan and Benn, because you just can't go out and get that.
That's right.
But you look at those models that have worked where you have superstars with, you know, Doughty and Kopitar, or of course we always talk about Kane and Taves and we forget Keith and that, but it's that high end, really top. And it's great to have these other first round picks that will fill out your first and second line, but having that true elite player, do the Canucks have a chance to develop that? Do you see that amongst their current crop? I know that's a little bit crystal ballish, Ed, but people have been in love with McCann, Vertanen, Hutton, Horvat. Mm-hmm. But do you see top end talent in there?
Yeah, okay. Let me answer that this way. I don't know.
Yeah,
I don't know. And it could go either way. And I'm thinking of two teams that I thought were going to take a bit of a leap this year that looked like they had really good young pieces in place and just needed a little nudge to get them there. And that's Winnipeg and Columbus.
Wow.
Winnipeg and Winnipeg's roster. You talk to anybody in the NHL, they look at Jacob Trouba and Mark Scheifele and Nick Ehlers, the kid from Denmark. And they've got a decent veteran cast there with Andrew Ladd and Blake Buffalo Wheeler. This was supposed to be, and it just hasn't happened for them.
But Ed,
and I don't, you know, you can't really figure out why.
No,
so,
but the NHL is now littered with that. When I said, wow, because I thought you were going to say Calgary and Colorado, which are the two people that, like, for years, again, all this young talent.
That's right.
Colorado's showing a bit more signs of life. And of course, Edmonton, huge rumors out of Edmonton that Chiarelli's ready to pull the pin and do a Sagan-like trade because it's like, you know what? No, Nugent Hopkins, you're done. We need to get something significant back.
Yeah.
And this idea that you do build with youth is a wonderful one, but as we look around the landscape of the NHL, it just, for a lot of teams, they seem like, yeah, okay, next step. But that next step is head first down the stairs.
No, I've said it a million times, and it is the great fallacy in the NHL that the learning curve is smooth and predictable, and it's not. You just never know. Are there reasons to believe it might happen for the Canucks? Yeah, I think so. You look where those guys are drafted. You look at their pedigree. And I will say this for them, just being around them, they're high character guys. Vertanen, McCann, Horvat, Hutton. They are kids you would bet on just because of their character. And again, that doesn't mean it will happen. And you know, you get getting back to Dallas, you look at the model that they built it on. Yeah, they had those two pieces, and you know how Tyler Sagan fell into their laps is, you know, we could do a whole podcast on that. But you just look at the way they build around it. You know, like the Canucks defense has kind of been a standing joke in this market for about 4 years now.
Yeah.
I was looking at Dallas's. There isn't a first round pick. There isn't, it's guys they've kind of accumulated trades, pickups here. John Klingberg, who is in the top five in NHL in scoring, and there's a great trivia question for people, was a fifth round draft pick. Okay, found money, but they got, you know, they traded for Alex Goligoski. They traded for Johnny Oduya, very serviceable, dependable defenseman. And the net result is the whole is greater than the sum of the parts with Dallas. But that defense, you know, it drives the engine. It completely supports the style they want to play. And, you know, I think it makes Dallas a legitimate Stanley Cup contender this year.
Yeah. And it's, you know, you mentioned Oduya. The other part, of course, is Patrick Sharp, that you talked about, got the goal last night. And I think that it does scream down to the fact that there is no template. You can't take someone else's model. Cause I used to love this. We'd heard this in this market for the longest time, the Boston model. Sure. Yep. Go out and find me another 6'9" dominant, competent with a puck defenseman. Yeah. I'd, you know, maybe develop one. you know, when you put Alex Edler in a rack, it's just, it's, you have to take the hand that you're dealt. And I think this idea again, that you look at Calgary or Edmonton, you can't rely exclusively on youth. So making those deals or free agent signings for the right pieces, whether it's experience, toughness, goal scoring, whatever it is. That's obviously the road that the Canucks need to find on their own. Before we move on, though, because there's a nice transition into your next subject, I did want to ask you about Bo Horvat. I think that's probably the most troubling thing for Canuck fans is this is McCann and Virtanen's first year. You see what you see, and you think that they'll still be okay as they move through. But in your mind, what is going on with Bo Horvat?
I would love to make excuses for him. But
which I think most people are, to be honest.
Yeah, no, and they are, but you can't. It has just gone on too long. Does he have too much on his plate? Yeah, probably. He's, you know, he is one of the lead penalty killers, second line centerman, second line power play. Probably a bit too much to ask, but it looked like he was ready for it at the second half of last season. I was one of the guys who said, you know, pencil him in for 20 goals and 50 points, which is exactly what this team needs. Clearly he's struggling with the role. He's not the first. He certainly won't be the last sophomore to endure that kind of slump in his second year. I still bet on the kid because I think he plays the right way. And I think he's a high character guy, but he is just struggling right now, and they need more from him. They need a lot more from him.
So,
for example, a couple of wingers who could score. Yeah. Might be something.
I agree with you, and that falls under the category of making excuses for him in a way, because it's not like he's been setting up players left, right, and center, and they've been missing the chances. But you're right. You can't do this by yourself.
Yeah. And if there's one thing I could say, the thing that's disappointing, he doesn't see the ice real well. He's not a great passer. And remember, we used to say the same things about a certain Ryan Kessler.
Yeah.
I think that's a skill he will develop. And I think we saw signs of it last year, but it just hasn't been there this year. Is that him? Is that the guys he's playing with? He has to step up and take responsibility for it.
Oh, well, while we're talking about tortured franchises here with the Canucks, your header for our next topic is the Lions. What the hell was that we just saw? And it's so funny to me, Ed, because
this is the BC Lions, not the Detroit Lions, by the way, because the Detroit Lions, again, we could kill a whole podcast.
Oh, I thought it was about the Detroit Lions.
Oh, it was actually the BC Lions.
Oh.
But you see how it works? Okay, it works on so many different
quickly
levels.
Then, I do want to talk about the Detroit Lions before we move to the BC Lions, only because with the tortured fan base thing, I'm sorry, I'm kind of speechless here because I cannot believe in the space of 4 days we've seen the Cleveland Browns lose the way they have and the Detroit Lions lose the way they have. And in this multimedia world, someone today, and I highlighted it in our morning skate, put out this remix of Cleveland Browns sadness to Adele's new single, Hello. And it is just so, like, it really does bring empathy for Browns fans. And I throw Canuck fans in there. We haven't quite had that torture that they have, but to lose a game like that and coming on the heels of the way the Browns lost, really is like, which franchise is the saddest?
No,
not even bad. Well, you can't say bad.
No, but the great part about the Detroit Lions is, you know, they'd won 3 out of 4, and then they get up and Botchard and I were watching the game in the press box while we were noodling away before the Canucks game started, and we were making jokes about they get up 17-0, they're just steamrolling
the
Packers.
Like, what the hell is wrong with Aaron Rodgers?
And it was like, yeah, break up the Lions for the, you know, geez, if they were on the table here, you know, they might come out NFC. No, there's no great teams in the NFC after Carolina.
Everyone lamenting the blown call against the Seahawks, like if they didn't have that, but yeah, they would be in the Super Bowl.
I didn't see the play, but we kind of started following it on NFL.com, and you know, they have, you don't get the video, but you get that, like, that stupid little graphic of the field and the ball moving back and forth. So it goes like
very
incomplete,
last play, I'm playing
incomplete,
down.
And then you see this giant blue arc going across the field and landing in the end zone. And Green Bay touchdown, Green Bay win. So I didn't see the replay until I got home, and it's perfect. It's perfect. The non-face mask that allows them to get to it. It's just so awesome that it would happen to the Lions.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And I have seen all the highlights afterwards, but at the time I was coaching my daughter's soccer team out at UBC, and you know, our boss here, Wayne Moriarty, who is a big Lions fan, he and I have an NFL picks pool every week, just, and I've been killing him this year. He chose the Lions in that game. And so I looked at the score as I was on the field, and it was 23-7, I think, at that point. I had seen that they were up 20-0. I'm like, okay, well, I've lost this one this week, right? As I come off the field, I go to check the score, and a text pops up from Wayne, again, who is a longtime Detroit Lions fan. And he just said, OMG, so Lions. And I'm like, I know it meant that they'd blown the game, but then I was thinking, well, how would they have blown that? Like, how on earth do you go about giving up in the last 4 minutes? What was a 17 point? And sure enough, that was so Lions. So let's move on to the other Lions.
Yes.
What the hell was that?
We just saw. Well, and it was. What the hell was that? It was just, it. Yeah, and look, I've kind of been around them a little more than usual, so it wasn't a complete surprise. But again, going back to last December when they hired Jeff Tedford, and this is going to be their John Huffnagel, this is the guy who's going to turn around the franchise and probably head it up for the next decade, the same way Huffnagel has done it in Calgary. And after 1 year, he's gone and looks to be headed back to Cal or some other NCAA school. And it's just, to use the same phrase again, it's a little Tortorella-esque, especially the way he's gone to ground, and we haven't heard his side of the story yet. But it's just so weird that it happens, and it's like the last 4 years for the Lions haven't happened. They may as well have, you know, done that neuralizer thing like Men in Black and wiped out the last 4 years, and, you know, it's from the 2011 Grey Cup, and now Wally's back in charge and he's running the show.
I think this is always a danger. Now, I don't know. One of our news editors here is probably the biggest Lions fan you could ever imagine, been a season ticket holder for years and years. And he seemed to think that this was all the Lions doing, that Tedford would have stayed. And I'm not so sure about that. You were around the team a lot more than me, but I do always think this is a danger, and I don't want to kick the CFL when it's down, but when you compare budget, salaries, ceiling, career path, everything in college football, there's nothing you can achieve in the CFL which gets you anywhere near the same stratosphere.
Yeah.
You know, you're talking about a big-time Pac-12 coach versus what you will make in the CFL, and the pressure, and pressure's way higher here. You know, you have your conference games down there, but you schedule a couple against a couple of JUCOs, and all of a sudden you're winning games by 40 points and everyone's happy. The CFL is always going to battle against that. But they had this pattern, Ed, in the 90s, 80s and 90s, of recycling Bob Obilovich, mm-hmm. Wally Buono, Don Matthews, even Hugh Campbell when he came back. And they kind of lost that whole generation of where is the new blood. And we thought the Lions were different that way. Mark Washington, certainly Mike Benavides was a fresh face. Is that the danger to you that, okay, going back to Old Faithful, we're really going back in time with Wally Buono rather than looking?
Yeah, and it is going against the curve in fairness to the CFL, where we've seen, you know, coaches like Kent Austin and Chris Jones and now Dave Dickinson emerging. So, yeah, it's this is the thing. I think, you know, Wally had built up so much goodwill, you know, and it all kind of climaxed with that 2011 Grey Cup. To me, over the last 4 years, he spent it all. So, like, he's starting with, you know, zero balance in that account. So, if he's as good as he thinks he is, and who knows, maybe he is. I mean, like I wrote there, it's not like his credentials are an issue with this guy, but he's 66 years old. He's played a big role in the mess the Lions are currently in, and now he's been, you know, given the broom and the mop to clean it all up. So it's going to be real interesting because the fan base is skeptical.
Well, absolutely, but is it? I find it fascinating because I, you know, at the time, just like everyone else, I looked at it and said, you know, the model, especially as you get older, is that you can't handle the two jobs. I mean, we saw this again, the NFL is much more involved, but guys like Mike Holmgren, you know, everyone who's tried to do this dual role as the GM and coach seemed to really get overwhelmed. And that was the trend in the CFL as well. So it was sort of like, you know what, while you're getting up there in years, give up one of those jobs. Maybe he gave up the wrong one. Is there, you know, is it like, frankly, this team hasn't had success since he stepped off the sidelines. Is there a chance that he will be a great coach and that, frankly, you should be looking at personnel as the issue of who you bring in?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, it's interesting when we go back over this. There's a school of thought that Wally was meddling with Tedford, and, you know, that's where the clash took place. I don't believe that, but I think the energy he was putting out there was such that Tedford always felt those eyes over his shoulders. And I don't think there was, and this is the feeling I got, is there was no unanimity of purpose between the coach and the GM. And that is so crucial. And I think Tedford felt, you know, the second guessing, you know, why isn't he doing that? It wasn't overt, but it was there. And, you know, like when Wally's out watching practice and, you know, not out in his office, but on the field, and he thinks he's being supportive and he thinks he's trying to help. And in Wally's worldview, that's probably true. But it sends another message to Tedford. Did it play a huge role? I don't know, but I think it did play a role in Tedford's decision.
Well, where I think, Ed, where that plays a role is that if you're not really on the same page philosophically, that's always going to be an issue. And it goes back to the famous Parcells quote when he was in New England and didn't feel that he was, you know, he didn't want Terry Glenn from Robert Kraft, who wanted an offensive player, you know, I want to cook Italian food and you're giving me ingredients to make Chinese. Mm-hmm. And I ultimately, I think that's where it seems to come about, because if you have the same philosophy, you know, I think someone like Mike Benavides would have struggled from being under Wally as a coach. Now, hey, yes. I've got the reins.
Yeah.
I'm going to be uncomfortable with, you know, thinking I have to do it dad's way versus a guy coming in and just not having the same philosophy on what you want out of players.
Yeah, my sense was that was much more of an issue with Mike, that kind of overt influence from Wally.
Yeah.
I think it was a little more subtle with Tedford, but I mean, God, you know, like Tedford, 54, you know, he's got like a resume in the States, which is every bit as impressive as Wally's. Plus, he was probably, if he wasn't making more, he was making as much as Wally. So, you know, that plays into it. So, you know, again, you know, we're back to year zero. Paul LaPolice's name has emerged as an offensive coordinator. I think that would help. They've got some pieces in place. There is no reason to think that it's going to be another lost year. But it's so important that
they can't
get
have
this
another
right.
Lost year.
No,
they
can't. I know they can't. I know they can't. Like, I mean, they're hanging on
the
by the thread.
The skepticism of the fan base, absolutely. Yeah.
But yeah, so you know, they've got the bright young quarterback. You know, that's a positive thing. They've got those pieces, so they've got to put an exciting winning product on the field.
Yeah. Now, speaking of exciting and winning, Coldplay announced as the NFL halftime show, and my reaction was very much the same as yours. You know, we're used to the NFL going so over the top that it's like, it's kind of a parody of itself in a way, like the Katy Perry halftime show last year with the giant lion and the whole left shark thing.
Okay. Yeah.
Like that in itself was like an SNL skit, a Lonely Planet, thing that was short that was making fun of what it actually is. So I was left very underwhelmed for, like, we've had these gold numbers and this huge deal about 50 getting away from the Roman numerals for this year. And it's Coldplay. I don't know.
To me, there was only one band they could have brought in to save it, and that's Metallica. 50th anniversary. And I'm not a huge fan, but I understand what they represent and what they mean. And that to me is the NFL. That's the 50th anniversary. There's even a Bay Area connection there. So that's it. So, I mean, to bring Coldplay in, like wimpy British rockers, for the 50th anniversary of the Super Bowl,
but
unbelievable. Either that or go back to the well. Give me Springsteen again. Give me Bon Jovi. Give me anything. Give me classic rockers, but don't give me Coldplay for Super Bowl.
See, but the funny thing is, Ed, I have been a big fan of giving you something that you wouldn't see anywhere else. So why not Metallica and Coldplay and Springsteen all at the same time? Let's have this, you know, if they can put...
That might blow the budget.
If they can put Aerosmith, Britney Spears, and NSYNC together...
Yeah, okay.
Then
yeah,
they can do that. And come on, blow the NFL's budget. Are you kidding me? And apparently this is for exposure. But here's a wacky idea I've had.
Mm-hmm.
Why do we have to have music? Why not have a stand-up comedy show and tell Chris Rock, Louis C.K., and Jerry Seinfeld, you're going to write the best 15 minutes of stand-up comedy together, football themed and everything else, and that's your halftime show.
That would be good, except I'm sorry, I've just seen so many like ESPY awards and things like that. Stand-up comedy with a sports theme usually doesn't work unless it's played to a room full of chubby white guys ourselves.
And that, no, you've hit the nail on the head, because the halftime show is not for us. We are going to watch for
Fair
football,
yeah.
And that's why we get Katy Perry. And, you know, other people have suggested it should be Taylor Swift for this Super Bowl because she's so big right now. But that's the issue, is they are trying to get the non-football fans to pay attention at the party. And the Super Bowl halftime show is not for the chubby white guy or, frankly, anyone who actually cares about football. But, you know, I just think, and that is the other thing. Anyone can tolerate music, humor. As such, you put Chris Rock on the Oscars and he's trying not to offend anyone. So he's not Chris Rock.
Yeah.
And that would be the problem with, you know, will Omaha like this as much as Boston likes this when you put a stand-up comedy act out there? But I do have to say I was underwhelmed last year with Bruno Mars, but yeah, I'm a chubby old white guy. This qualifies for Get Off Our Lawn.
Yeah, it does. Actually it does. No, I think it's kind of, and I think the problem is they've gone through the Rolodex of classic rockers.
Yeah.
They've done The Who, they've done Stones, they've done, unless they just made Springsteen, and I'd be all for that. Just make Springsteen the show every year.
Yeah.
I think, you know, he's American, he ticks a lot of boxes. I'd be for that. When you're talking about, but I just, I'd say, well, you know, okay, why didn't they go for Adele then? Why didn't they go for Sam Smith? That would draw an alternative crowd. That would draw a non-traditional football.
It certainly would, but as did Katy Perry.
Football crowd.
So, you know, USA Today this morning did their ranking of the best halftime shows. So predictably, they have Michael Jackson as number one, which I just can't handle at all. Not only because I'm not a terribly big fan of his music, but pedophiles creep me out. And I don't like to give them credit for anything else, but there you go. You know, we're still not talking about the defensive game plans that Jerry Sandusky put together in light of his other activities. So I can't laud Michael Jackson that way. But I do have a specific favorite that I like. Is there anything other than Up With People which stands out to you?
I loved Up With People. Okay, I'll say this one just because I was there. And I didn't actually see them, but I heard them, but I attended the press conference, and that was U2 in New Orleans.
That's mine.
Oh, okay. Yeah. In 2002. And it just, if I may, it was such a noteworthy event on so many levels. And the biggest one, it was the real first big public event after 9/11. And the level of security, it's funny now when I think back on it, but I remember the shock value, the level of security we encountered in New Orleans. Metal detectors, are you kidding? Just to get in the convention center, just to get into press conferences? And when I look back on it now, it was nothing. It was just, you know, we breezed around. But I did make a point to go to the press conference just to say I saw Bono and The Edge and Larry Clayton.
Yeah.
And who's the other guy?
Well, Bono, The Edge, Larry Clayton, Adam Mullen.
Adam Mullen. Yeah, that was it. And then the funny thing was
Larry Mullen and Adam Clayton.
Yeah, whatever. The funny thing was, you know, like at halftime, it's to do with the logistics of writing and having access to locker rooms, and you don't want to be doing it at the final horn. So at halftime, I kind of walked down into this work area, and I actually heard them play. I'm pretty sure they played Streets With No Name and a couple of other things. So I heard, and that was all. Almost neat in its own way, just to hear it. It was like kind of haunting and all the rest of it. So,
it reminded you of the Canucks pregame intro. Although at that time, I think they were using Thunderstruck. Hey, why isn't AC/DC out there? That'd be a good one.
I'd go for them. But
I agree with you. For me, number one is U2, and it was special circumstance. I remember they had this. They had the backdrop where every single name of the victims from 9/11 was scrolled by, and it was very poignant. But overall, you know, they got into this big spectacle and mashing groups together, and then you had The Nipple with Janet Jackson, and that ruined all that, and that's how we fell into it. Because, God forbid, you know, CNN showing live bullet-riddled bodies on the street with automatic weapons strewn around this week, and that's okay, but a nipple scene from literally 400 yards away, you know,
tastefully covered in a pasty, as I recall too. I'm sorry. Every time I think of that, I think of that Seinfeld episode where
the nip. Yeah.
Hey, nip, stop calling me.
I didn't see it. He grabs his head, shoves it. Do you get a good look? It was fantastic. Yeah. One of the best ever. Well, on that note, we will kind of wrap it up. It's, been fun today. I had lots of stuff going on. You can read Ed's stuff at theprovince.com, pick up the copy, of the Sunday Province. You will have a column in there. We have the Big Bad Bruins. Mm. I just quickly before we finish, Jonathan McDonald ran a poll about who the Canucks' biggest rival is for the 700th time. And it came out, though, Calgary, predictably. And I just, wow. When Calgary come to town, I don't sense any sense of an event.
Since 2004?
No, I know. And the Bruins were fifth. They were behind also the Kings, the Ducks.
Wow.
And the Blackhawks. And there were only, it was only 8% of the vote. And I'm like, this is such a bandwagon town. We're even bandwagon in our hate.
Well, quite frankly, the Canucks aren't good enough to be rivals with anybody.
Well, neither are Boston.
Right now. Oh, no, that's true. Maybe they deserve each other.
Brad Marchand's still coming to town. But they play each other. Coming to town.
It's once a year, though. If they, you know, if they played a little more, you know, it just, I'm sorry, I got to go old. So I got to go get off my lawn on this one. But like in the 80s, when the divisional lines and the schedules were what they were,
yeah.
And teams played each other 6-8 times, that's when you had a chance for these rivalry to grow some teeth. But now forget it. And it's just, and I know 2011 will forever be burned into Canucks fans' consciences. But it hasn't been the same since that regular season game the following year.
Yeah.
Maybe that's what we need Cody Hodgson back to revive the
Well, yeah, you're right. Rivalry. I mean, Tim Thomas and Milan Lucic move on and it's not the same anymore. Yeah. But I still say I was a little surprised that Canuck fans can't. And I still think it'll be a better atmosphere on Saturday night than it will be the next time the Flames are here. But that's just me.
All right.
All right, Ed, thanks very much. Thanks for listening, everyone. We will talk to you next week.